The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Tringo Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and continuing with our selections from the New Yorker archives this month, I'll finish the profile of Ernest Hemingway we started last week, and then we'll follow that with a short story by E.B. White from the October 14th, 1950 edition of the New Yorker magazine. So we will finish Lillian Ross's profile of Ernest Hemingway, entitled How Do You Like It Now, Gentlemen, which was published in the May 13th, 1950 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Ernest Hemingway has arrived in New York, and he and the author and his wife and his son Patrick are in the Metropolitan Museum as we continue the story. Mrs. Hemingway called to us. She was looking at Portrait of the Artist by Van Dyck. Hemingway looked at it, nodded approval, and said, "In Spain, we had a fighter pilot named Whitey Dahl. So Whitey came to me one time and said, 'Mr. Hemingway, is Van Dyck a good painter?' And I said, 'Yes, he is.' And he said, 'Well, I'm glad because I have one in my room and I like it very much. And I'm glad he's a good painter because I like him.' The next day, Whitey was shot down. We all walked over to Rubens' The Triumph of Christ Over Sin and Death. Christ is shown surrounded by snakes and angels, and is being watched by a figure in a cloud. Mrs. Hemingway and Patrick said they thought it didn't look like the usual Rubens. 'Yeah, he did that all right,' Hemingway said authoritatively. 'You can tell the real just as a bird dog can tell. Smell them. Or from having lived with very poor, but very good painters.' Well, that settled that, and we went on to the Bruegel room. It was closed, we discovered. The door bore a sign that read, 'Now undertaking repairs.' 'Well, they have our indulgence,' Hemingway said, and took another drink from his flask. 'I sure miss the good Bruegel,' he said as we moved along. 'It's the great one of the harvesters. It's a lot of people cutting grain, but he uses the grain geometrically to make it an emotion that is so strong for me that I can hardly take it.' We came to El Greco's green view of Toledo and stood looking at it a long time. 'This is the best picture in the museum for me, and Christ knows there are some lovely ones,' Hemingway said. Patrick admired several paintings Hemingway didn't approve of. Every time this happened, Hemingway got into an involved technical discussion with his son about it. Patrick would shake his head and laugh and say he respected Hemingway's opinions. He didn't argue much. 'What the hell,' Hemingway said suddenly. 'I don't want to be an art critic. I just want to look at pictures and be happy with them and learn from them. Now this, for me, is a damn good picture.' And he stood back and peered at a Reynolds entitled Colonel George Coosemaker, which shows the colonel leaning against a tree and holding his horse's bridle. 'Now, this colonel is a son of a bitch who was willing to pay money to the best portrait painter of his day just to have himself painted,' Hemingway said and gave a short laugh. 'Look at the man's arrogance and the strength in the neck of the horse and the way the man's legs hang. He's so arrogant he can afford to lean against a tree.' We separated for a while and looked at paintings individually. And then Hemingway called us over and pointed to a picture labeled in large letters, Catherine Lorillard Wolfe, and in small ones by Cabanel. 'This is where I got confused as a kid in Chicago,' he said. 'My favorite painters for a long time were Bunte and Ryerson, two of the biggest and wealthiest families in Chicago. I always thought the names in big letters were the painters.' After we reached the Cezanne and Degas and the other Impressionists, Hemingway became more and more excited and discoursed on what each artist could do and how and what he had learned from each. Patrick listened respectfully and didn't seem to want to talk about painting techniques anymore. Hemingway spent several minutes looking at Cezanne's Rocks, Forest of Fontainebleau, This is what we try to do in writing. This and this and the woods and the rocks we have to climb over, he said. Cézanne is my painter after the early painters. Wonder, wonder painter. Degas was another wonder painter. I've never seen a bad Degas. You know what he did with the bad Degas? He burned them. Hemingway took another long drink from his flask. We came to Manet's pastel portrait of Mademoiselle Valtresse de la Bigne, a young woman with blonde hair coiled on the top of her head. Hemingway was silent for a while, looking at it. Finally, he turned away. Manet could show the bloom people have when they're still innocent and before they've been disillusioned, he said. As we walked along, Hemingway said to me, I can make a landscape like Mr. Paul Cézanne. I learned how to make a landscape from Mr. Paul Cézanne by walking through the Luxembourg Museum 1,000 times with an empty gut. And I'm pretty sure that if Mr. Paul was around, he would like the way I make them and be happy that I learned it from him. He had learned a lot from Mr. Johann Sebastian Bach, too. In the first paragraphs of Farewell, I used the word and consciously over and over, the way Mr. Johann Sebastian Bach used a note in music when he was emitting counterpoint. I can write almost like Mr. Johann sometimes, or anyway, so he would like it. All such people are easy to deal with because we all know you have to learn. Papa, look at this, Patrick said. He was looking at Meditation on the Passion by Carpaccio. Patrick said it had a lot of strange animals in it for a religious painting. Huh? Hemingway said. Those painters always put the sacred scenes in the part of Italy they liked the best, or where they came from, or where their girls came from. They made their girls into the Madonnas, and this is supposed to be Palestine, and Palestine is a long way off, he figures. So he puts in a red parrot, and he puts in a deer and a leopard, and then he thinks, this is the Far East, and it's far away. So he puts in the Moors, the traditional enemy of the Venetians. He paused and looked to see what else the painter had put in his picture. Then he gets hungry, so he puts in rabbits, he said. Goddamn mouse. We saw a lot of good pictures, mouse. Don't you think 2 hours is a long time looking at pictures? Everyone agreed that 2 hours was a long time looking at pictures. So Hemingway said that we would skip the Goyas and that we would all go to the museum again when they returned from Europe. It was still raining when we came out of the museum. Goddamn, I hate to go out in the rain, Hemingway said. Goddamn, I hate to get wet. Charles Scribner was waiting in the lobby of the hotel. Ernest, he said, shaking Hemingway's hand. He is a dignified, solemn, slow-speaking gentleman with silvery hair. We've been looking at pictures, Charlie, Hemingway said as he went up in the elevator. They have some pretty good pictures now, Charlie. Scribner nodded and said, yeah, yeah. Was fun for a country boy like me, Hemingway said. Yeah, yeah, said Scribner. We went into the suite and took off our coats. Hemingway said we would have lunch right there. He called room service, and Mrs. Hemingway sat down at the desk to finish her letter. Hemingway sat down on the couch with Mr. Scribner and began telling him that he had been jamming, like a rider in a 6-day bike race, and Patrick sat quietly in a corner and watched his father. The waiter came in and passed out menus. Scribner said he was going to order the most expensive item on the menu because Hemingway was paying for it. He laughed tentatively, and Patrick laughed to keep him company. The waiter retired with our orders, and Scribner and Hemingway talked business for a while. Scribner wanted to know whether Hemingway had the letters he had written to him. Hemingway said, I carry them every place I go, Charlie, together with a copy of the poems of Robert Browning. Scribner nodded, and from the inner pocket of his jacket took some papers, copies of the contract for the new book, he said. The contract provided for an advance of $25,000 against royalties, beginning at 15%. Hemingway signed the contract and got up from the couch. And then he said, Never ran as no genius, but I'll defend the title again against all the good young new ones. And he lowered his head, put his left foot forward, and jabbed at the air with a left and a right. Never let them hit you solid, he said. Scribner wanted to know where Hemingway could be reached in Europe. Care of the Germany Trust Company in Paris, Hemingway told him. When we took Paris, I tried to take that bank and got smacked back, he said, and laughed a shy laugh. I thought it would be awfully nice if I could take my own bank. Yeah, Scribner said. What are you planning to do in Italy, Ernest? Hemingway said he would work in the mornings and see his Italian friends and go duck hunting in the afternoons. We shot 331 ducks to 6 guns there one afternoon, he said. Mary shot good, too. Mrs. Hemingway looked up. Any girl who marries Papa has to learn how to carry a gun, she said, and returned to her letter writing. I went hunting once in Suffolk, England, Scribner said. Everyone waited politely for him to continue. I remember they gave me goose eggs for breakfast in Suffolk. Then we went out to shoot. I didn't know how to get my gun off. Safety. Hunting is sort of a good life, Hemingway said. Better than Westport or Bronxville, I think. After I learned how to get my gun off safety, I couldn't hit anything, Scribner said. I'd like to make the big Monte Carlo shoot and the championship of the world at San Remo, Hemingway said. I'm in pretty good shape to shoot either one. I'm not a spectator. It's not a spectator sport at all, but exciting to do and wonderful to manage. I used to handle Wolfie in big shoots. He's a great shot. It was like handling a great horse. I finally got one, Scribner said timidly. Got what? asked Hemingway. A rabbit, Scribner said. I shot this rabbit. They haven't held the big Monte Carlo shoot since 1939, Hemingway said. Only two Americans ever won it in 74 years. Shooting gives me a good feeling. A lot of it is being together and friendly instead of feeling you are in some place where everybody hates you and wishes you ill. It is faster than baseball, and you are out on one strike. The telephone rang, and Hemingway picked it up, listened, said a few words, and then turned to us and said that an outfit called Endorsements Incorporated had offered him $4,000 to pose as a man of distinction. I told them I wouldn't drink the stuff for $4,000, he said. I told them I was a champagne man. I'm trying to be a good guy, but it's a difficult trade. What you win in Boston, you lose in Chicago. And now we'll turn to the October 14th, 1950 edition of the New Yorker magazine for a short story by E.B. White entitled Across the Street and Into the Grill. This is my last and best and true and only meal, thought Mr. Purney as he descended at noon and swung east on the beat-up sidewalk of 45th Street. Just ahead of him was the girl from the reception desk. I'm a little fleshed up around the crook of the elbow, thought Purney, but I commute good. He quickened his step to overtake her and felt the pain again. What a stinking trade it is, he thought. But after what I've done to other assistant treasurers, I can't hate anybody. 16 deads, and I don't know how many possibles. The girl was near enough now so he could smell her fresh receptiveness and the lint in her hair. Her skin was light blue, like the side of horses. I love you, he said, and we are going to lunch together for the first and only time, and I love you very much. Hello, Mr. Purney, she said, overtaken. Let's not think of anything. A pair of fantails flew over from the sad old Guarantee Trust Company, and their wings set for landing. A lovely double, thought Purney, as he pulled. Shall we go to the Hotel Biltmore on Vanderbilt Avenue, which is merely a feeder lane for the great streets? Or shall we go to Schraff's, where my old friend Botticelli is a captain of girls, and where they have the mayonnaise in fiascos? Let's go to the Schraff's, said the girl, though. But I first must phone Mummy. She stepped into a public booth and dialed true and well, using her finger. Then she telephoned. As they walked on, she smelled good. She smells good, thought Purney. But that's all right. I add good. And when we get the shrefs, I'll order from the menu, which I like very much indeed. They entered the restaurant. The wind was still west, ruffling the edges of the cookies. In the elevator, Kearney took the controls. "I'll run it," he said to the operator. "I checked out long ago." He stopped True at the third floor, and they stepped off into the men's grill. "Good morning, my assistant treasurer," said Botticelli, coming forward with a fiasco in his hand. He nodded at the girl, who he knew was from the West 70s and whom he desired. "Can you drink the water here?" asked Pruny. He had the fur trapper's eye and took in the room at a glance, noting that there was one empty table and three pretty waitresses. Botticelli led the way to the table in the corner, where Pruny's flanks would be covered. "Alexander's," said Pruny, 86-1. "The way Christmas is them. Is this table all right, daughter?" Botticelli disappeared and returned soon, carrying the old Indian blanket. "That's the same blanket, isn't it?" asked Pruny. "Yes, to keep the wind off," said the captain, smiling from the backs of his eyes. "It's still west. It should bring the ducks in tomorrow, the chef thinks." Mr. Pruny and the girl from the reception desk crawled down under the table and pulled the Indian blanket over them so that it was solid and good and covered them right. The girl put her hand on his wallet. It was cracked and old and held his commutation book.
"We're having fun, aren't we?" she asked.
"Yes, sister," he said. "I have here the soft-shell crabs, my assistant treasurer," said Botticelli, "and another fiasco of the 1926. This one is cold."
"D the soft-shell crabs," said Pruny from under the blanket. He put his arm around the receptionist good. "Do you think we should have a green pokeweed salad?" she asked. "Or shall we not think of anything for a while?"
"We shall not think of anything for a while, and Botticelli would bring the pokeweed if there was any," said Pruny. "It isn't the season." Then he spoke to the captain. "Botticelli, do you remember when we took all the mailing envelopes from the stockroom, spit on the flaps, and then drank rubber cement till the foot soldiers arrived?"
"I remember, my assistant treasurer," said the captain. "It was a little joke they had."
"He used to mimeograph pretty good," said Pruny to the girl. "But that was another war.
Do I bore you, mother?"
"Please, keep telling me about your business experiences, but not the rough parts."
She touched his hand, where the knuckles were scarred and stained by so many old mimeographings.
"Are both your flanks covered, my dearest?" she asked, plucking at the blanket.
They felt the Alexanders in their eyeballs, 86-1. "Shafts is a good place, and we're having fun, and I love you," Pruny said. He took another swallow of the 1926. It was a good and careful swallow. "The stockroom men were very brave," he said. "But it is a position where it is extremely difficult to stay alive. Just outside that room, there is a little bare-faced high boy, and it is in the way of the stuff that is being brought up." "The hell with it. When you make a breakthrough, daughter, first you clean out the baskets and the half-wits, and all the time they have the fire escapes taped. They also shell you with old production orders, many of them approved by the general manager in charge of sales. I am boring you, and I will not at this time discuss the general manager in charge of sales, as we are unquestionably being listened to by that waitress over there who is setting out the decoys."
"I'm going to give you my piano," the girl said, "so that when you look at it, you can think of me. It will be something between us."
"Call up and have them bring the piano to the restaurant," said Pruny. "Another fiasco, Botticello." They drank the sauce. When the piano came, it wouldn't play. The keys were stuck.
"Never mind. We'll leave it there, cousin," said Pruny.
They came out from under the blanket, and Pruny tipped the waitress exactly 15% minus withholding. They left the piano in the restaurant, and when they went down the elevator and out and turned into the old, hard, beat-up pavement of Fifth Avenue and headed south toward 45th Street where the pigeons were, the air was as clean as your grandfather's howitzer. The wind was still west. "I commute good," thought Pruny.
looking at his watch. And he felt the old pain of going back to Scarsdale again. And now we will turn to the July 30th, 1949 edition of The New Yorker for an essay by James Thurber entitled The American Literary Scene. In parentheses, after reading several essays in English magazines on the plight of the American writer and the nature of the American male. I have but now returned to England and to my tranquil pen after spending six interesting, rather, but scarcely restful weeks in America. It had been my purpose in setting out, or perhaps I should say my thought, to look at, but not exactly to examine, in the journalistic sense of the word, what is going on in the field, or fields, they are quite separate, of book and magazine publishing over there. I bore in my portfolio letters pressed upon me by various friends, to Mr. Horace Lorimer of the Saturday Review Post, a Mr. Bach, whom my distinguished compatriot, Lord Tweedley, had visited in Tamiami long years since, and who turned out unhappily to be deceased, and to the strenuous Mr. William Rose, who, in addition to writing for New Yorker, conducts a column of chat about the underworld in the New York Herald, known for something amusing American reason as the Trib. Mr. Rose was not in when I called at New Yorker, a weekly journal of capricious opinion published with massive drollery in an enormous hotel of the same name, and I was unable, alas, to present my letter to Mr. Horace Lorimer, since I could not find him in Boston, and, indeed, no one seemed to have heard of him. At this point, I am afflicted by the uneasy suspicion that my American readers, if perchance I have any, will condemn this small commentary for its confessed, if flaunted, lack of the kind of wearisome research of which Americans, in their desperate and deplorable love of fact, are so intensely avid. I have not checked, as they would say, a solitary statement herein contained. I proudly, even gaily, protest that at no time during my sojourn abroad did I descend to the vulgarity of taking notes, to use another Americanism. My prayer for forgiveness, if such I must seek, rises from the heart of a stout conviction that speculation, when cramped by certainties, is eased of its wonder and its warmth. So much, then, for apology. New Yorker, the journal and hotel rises, I should imagine, to a height of 1,000 feet, and it contains somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 rooms, of which, I fancy, a third to a half is given over to the editorial offices. This amazing plant labors incessantly to turn out, on each Wednesday, a periodical that contains surely not more than 20,000 words of letterpress. One should not be led to assume that New Yorker is the most commodious plant in the city of New York. The American Broadcasting System, owned by Time Holiday Limited, I believe someone said, is housed in Rockefeller's Plaza, a gigantic world of steel and granite, somewhat north of my hotel, that once accommodated the entire population of Kansas City. The ABS employs 150,000 persons, or perhaps 100,000 more than New Yorker. The staff of that weekly is made up exclusively of wealthy residents of the city, curiously devoted to its prodigious commerce and shipping, its eccentric millionaires and their wives, and its several legends. The metropolis, of course, has no traditions. It has several times been pointed out, I expect, that New Yorker letterpress sounds as if it were the work of one man. This comes delightfully close to being true. The letterpress is, in reality, written by three men, Mr. Alexander Wolcott, our own Mr. John Collier, and Mr. William Rose himself. Mr. Rose actually has two styles of writing, the exasperatingly lucid and understandable prose of New Yorker, in which one may never find comfort for even a moment in a weirdly managed construction or a charmingly uncorrected error of printing, and the sort of hard-hitting bully boy mannerism he affects in his underworld gossip. On the side,
It's interesting to note, Mr. Rose manufactures hundreds of kinds of tinned goods, which are marketed under the trade label of White Rose. I was appalled to learn at a cocktail party, which degenerated, as not infrequently happens, into an alcoholic rout, that the Rose Weekly, after employing America's most distinguished novelist, Truman Capote, had let him go out of hand. My informant, a Mr. Busby or Bixby, it was infernally noisy at that party, told me that the magazine's controlling stock is held by a syndicate of Southern bankers, or bakers, who had conceived the fantastic notion that Mr. Truman's novel, Other Rooms, Other Voices, was a deliberate assault on the virtue of Southern womanhood. He was given the sack, without ado or farewell, and New York publishers are now madly bidding against one another for the rights to his future work. This bidding is an odd and graceless procedure in which the rival publishers outdo one another in wining and dining the prospective author. They are not above buying him expensive cars and other costly presents, and advance royalties in the amount of $50,000 are by no means unknown. Publishers all occupy skyscraper penthouses, or random houses, and although I was never actually in one of them, I can see them as clearly as if I had been. The publishers dictate ideas for novels to the writers, supplying them with the titles, and in some instances, writing the books themselves. The American custom of seducing one's best friend, and later killing oneself while on a spree, out of fear that one is actually in love with one's best friend, is the basic theme most recently insisted on by the publishers. It is good to be able to report that a small but sturdy group of male American writers, there has been no woman novelist since Miss Cather's death, stubbornly and courageously refused to be enslaved or chivied about. This little band consists of Ernest Hemingway, Eliot Paul, the Dreiser brothers, Henry Miller, Faulkner, Upton Sinclair, Earl Stanley Gardner, and possibly a few others. The chances of this slender list being appreciably lengthened are far from good. A great many young American writers have made sizable fortunes before the age of 30 and have retired and passed their time drinking and attending the boxing matches. Drinking in the American literary set has reached unbelievable heights, or depths, depending upon one's view. I think Spender, in his Horizon essay, went a bit far in intimating that many older authors have surrendered themselves completely to alcoholism. That word connotes, indeed it specifically defines, a form of almost incurable disease whose most distinctive characteristic is the inability to stop after one has started. I am sure that I got about as much as Spender, but it is obvious that he is able to sit up later than I am. Since all the American writers I met, of every age, were still carrying on at evening parties after I had left, it is impossible for me to estimate fairly how many of them eventually stopped and how many were unable to stop. I was informed that one American writer sat for 7 days in an actor's club without going home or ceasing his tippling. But this was told me by a gentleman well into his own fourth day and unfolding rapidly, and its credibility is perhaps negligible. It is safe to say that quantitative literary drinking in America is well beyond any and every mark that we English writers might fear or hope to achieve. American writers speak quite openly and freely of drinking their luncheon, and of being poured into trains. The latest expressions for being intoxicated are buzzed, punch-struck, and mugged. The social intercourse of the American writer is realized almost exclusively in public houses or private homes and flats between the hours of 5 p.m. and 4 a.m. the following day. When the writers meet in a public house, there is little conversation, the 11 hours of confined but distant intimacy being given over to a gambling game known as matches.
I think as much as $40,000 may change hands in one night. The superficial observer might regard these nocturnal meetings as a sign of gregariousness, but they are, in reality, gloomily planned assemblages of separate lonelinesses. Friendship in America is indicated and proved by a steady flow of insult and contumely between friends, who smilingly accuse each other of insanity, depravity, spiritual damnation, duplicity, conspiracy, and the stealing of flowers from the graves of mothers. Some American writers who have known each other for years have never met in the daytime or when both were sober. The coming together of writers in the home or flat of one of their number is invariably a signal for trouble to start. There is no discussion to speak of, but controversy rages shortly after all are seated in the living or rumpus room. A controversy usually arises out of a fiercely stated prejudice, hatred, or admiration by the host of one of his guests. A novelist or essayist is likely to get to his feet on his 20th or 21st highball and announce that he is the greatest goddamn writer in the world, or that one of his friends is. This is instantly challenged by one or more candidates for the special distinction of greatest goddamn writer in the world. The commonest terms of opprobrium during these bitter debates are interior decorator, poet, chef, florist, and milliner, since Americans believe that a talent in any of these directions is prima facie evidence of a lack of virility, or at the very least, a dearth of the true go-getter spirit. The foreign writer who is fortunate enough to be present at one of those rare evening parties at which there is a discussion instead of argument is likely to be at a loss, nonetheless, since the conversation holds tenaciously to such highly specialized subjects as the Buick, the Pontiac, the Cadillac, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Cincinnati Communists, money, clothes, success, ladies of questionable discretion, and heels, both goddamn and round. I had wished to make some small exploration of Hollywood, home of the millionaire cinema writers, whose lifespan is so shockingly brief. I understand that they are taken directly from the studio to the cemetery. Such is the pace even of death in California. I must confess, however, that my farthest west in America was a hotel in the 8th Avenue, a region of New York City charmingly named the Devil's Kitchen. The trip to this hotel marked the end of my American adventures. Others will follow me to those violent shores, just as, in the past, others have preceded me, from Mrs. Trollope to Jeffrey Gore and Evelyn Waugh. The American writer will always be a richly rewarding subject for study. He does not, to be sure, like to be studied, but he loves to be listened to, and thus the path of the foreign observer is made comparatively easy. It is well to remember that he resents all and every criticism of himself, his colleagues, or anything else, and he is likely to regard whatever you may say as goddamn patronizing. The American writer is constitutionally unable to take it, but there is always the danger that he may turn on one and dish it up. In such event, it is advisable to apologize and to powder out before objects are thrown. Of course, if one has nothing to apologize for, one does not want to meekly put up and shut up. It is rather difficult, I see, to formulate a code of behavior for the Englishman in America that is at once judicious and honorable. I shall continue to think about it. And now, from the June 17, 1961 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read a short story written by John Updike entitled Lifeguard. Beyond doubt, I am a splendid fellow. In the autumn, winter, and spring, I execute the duties of a student of divinity. In the summer, I disguise myself in my skin and become a lifeguard. My slightly narrow and gingerly hirsute, but not necessarily unmanly chest becomes brown. My smooth back turns the color of caramel, which, in conjunction with the whipped cream of my white pith helmet, gives me, some of my teenage satellites assure me, a delightfully edible appearance. My legs, which I myself can study, cocked as they are before me while I repose on my elevated wooden throne, are dyed a lusterless maple walnut that accentuates their articulate strength. Correspondingly, the hairs of my body are bleached blonde, so that my legs have the pointed elegance of, within the flower, umber anthers dusted with pollen. For 9 months of the year, I pace my pale hands and burning eyes through immense pages of biblical text, barnacled with fudging commentary, through multi-volumed apologetics, crouched in a falsely friendly Victorian voice, and bound in subtly abrasive boards of finely ridged, prefaded red, through handbooks of liturgy and histories of dogma, through the bewildering duplicities of Tillich's divine politicking, through the suave table talk of Father Darcy, Etienne Gilson, Jacques Maritain, and other such moderns mistakenly put at their ease by the exquisite antique furniture and overstuffed larder of the hospitable St. Thomas. Though the terrifying attempts of Kierkegaard, Berdyaev, and Barth to scourge God into being, I sway appalled on the ladder of minus signs by which theologians would surmount the void. I tiptoe like a burglar into the house of naturalism to steal the silver. An acrobat, I swing from wisp to wisp. Newman's iridescent cobwebs crush in my hands. Pascal's blackboard mathematics are erased by a passing shoulder. The cave drawings, astonishingly vital by candlelight, of those aboriginal magicians, Paul and Augustine, in daylight, fade into anthropology. And the diverting productions of literary flirts like Chesterton, Eliot, Auden, and Green, whether they regard Christianity as a pastel forest designed for a fairyland romp or a deliciously miasmic pit from which chiaroscuro can be mined with mechanical buckets. In the end, all infallibly strike, despite the comic variety of gongs and mallets, the note of the rich young man who on the coasts of Judea refused, in dismay, to sell all that he had. Then, for the remaining quarter of the solar revolution, I rest my eyes on a sheet of brilliant sand printed with the runes of naked human bodies. That there is no discrepancy between my studies, that the texts of the flesh complement those of the mind, is the easy burden of my sermon. On the backrest of my lifeguard's chair is painted a cross, true, a red cross, signifying bandages, splints, spirits of ammonia, and sunburn unguents. Nevertheless, it comforts me. Each morning, mounting into my chair, my athletic and youthfully fuzzy toes expertly gripping the slats that make a ladder, it is as if I am climbing onto an immense, rigid, loosely fitting vestment. Again, in each of my roles, I sit attentively perched on the edge of an immensity, that the sea, with its multiform and mysterious hosts, its savage and senseless rages, no longer comfortably serves as a divine metaphor, indicates how severely humanism has corrupted the apples of our creed. We seek God in flowers and good deeds and the immensities of blue that surround the little scabs of land upon which we draw our lives to their unsatisfactory conclusions are sufficed by science with vacuous horror. I myself can hardly bear the thought of stars or begin to count the mortalities of coral. But from my chair, the sea, slightly distended by my higher perspective, seems a misty old gentleman, stretched at his ease in an immense armchair, which has for arms the arms of this bay and for an antimacassar the freshly laundered sky. Sailboats float on his surface like idle and unrelated but benevolent thoughts. The soughing of the surf is the rhythmic lifting of his ripple-stitched vest as he breathes.
Consider. We enter the sea with a shock. Our skin and blood shout in protest. But that instant, that leap, past, what do you find? Ecstasy and buoyance. Swimming offers a parable. We struggle and thrash and drown. We succumb, even in despair, and float and are saved. With what timidity, with what a sense of trespass, do I set forward even this obliquely, a thought so official? Forgive me. I am not yet ordained. I am too disordered to deal with the main text. My competence is marginal, and I will confine myself to the gloss of flesh with which this particular margin, this one beach, is annotated each day. Here the cinema of life is run backwards. The old are the first to arrive. They are idle and have lost the gift of sleep. Each of our bodies is a clock that loses time. Young as I am, I can hear in myself the protein acids ticking. I wake at odd hours, and in the shuddering darkness and silence, feel my death rushing toward me like an express train. The older we get, and the fewer the mornings left to us, the more deeply dawn stabs us awake. The old ladies wear wide straw hats and, in their hat's shadows, smiles as wide, which they bestow upon each other, upon salty shells they discover in the morning's smooth sand, and even upon me, downy-eyed from my night of dissipation. The gentlemen are often incongruous. Withered white legs support brazen barrel chests, absurdly potent, bustling with white froth. How these old roosters preen on their condition. With what fatuous expertness they swim in the icy water, always, however, prudently parallel to the shore, at a depth no greater than their height. Then come the middle-aged, burdened with children and aluminum chairs. The men are scarred with the marks of their vocation, the red forearms of the gasoline station attendant, the pale X on the back of the overall-wearing mason or carpenter, the clammers' nicked ankles. The hair on their bodies has as many patterns as matted grass. The women are wrinkled, but fertile, like the Iraqi rivers that cradled the seeds of our civilization. Their children are odious. From their gaunt faces leer all the vices, the greeds, the grating urgencies of the adult, unsoftened by maturity's reticence and fatigue. Except that here and there a girl, the eldest daughter, wearing a knit suit striped horizontally with green, purple, and brown, walks slowly, carefully, puzzled by the dawn enveloping her thick, smooth body, her waist not yet nipped, but her throat elongated. Finally come the young. The young matrons bring fat and fussy infants who gobble the sand like sugar, who toddle blissfully into the surf and bring me bolt upright on my throne. My whistle tweets. The mothers rouse. Many of these women are pregnant again and sluggishly lie in their loose suits like cows tranced in a meadow. They gossip politics and smoke incessantly, and lift their troubled eyes in wonder as a trio of flat-stomached nymphs parade past. These maidens take all of our eyes, the vivacious redhead, freckled and white-footed, pushing against her boy and begging to be ducked, the solemn brunette, transporting the vase of herself with held breath, the dimpled blonde in the bib and diapers of her bikini, the lambent fuzz of her midriff shimmering like a cat's belly. Lust stuns me like the sun.
You are offended that a divinity student lusts? What prigs the unchurched are! Are not our assaults in the supernatural lascivious, a kind of indecency? If only you knew what Sadian gradations, what frightful psychologically spelunking our general transcendentalist professors set us to as preparation for our work, which is to shine in the darkness. I feel that my lust makes me glow.
I grow cold in my chair like a torch of ice as I study beauty. I have studied much of it, wearing all styles of bathing suit and facial expression, and have come to this conclusion. A woman's beauty lies not in any exaggeration of the specialized zones, nor in any general harmony that could be worked out by means of the sectio aurea or a similar aesthetic superstition, but in the arabesque of the spine, the curve by which the back modulates into the buttocks. It is here that grace sits and rides a woman's body. I watch from my white throne and pity woman, deplore the demented judgment that drives him toward the braggart muscularity of the mesomorph and the prosperous complacence of the endomorph, when it is we ectomorphs who pack in our scrawny sinews and exacerbated nerves the most intense gift, the most generous shelter of love. To desire a woman is to desire to save her. Anyone who has endured intercourse that was neither predatory nor hurried knows how thorough it is we descend with a partner into the grotesque and delicate shadows that until then have remained locked in the most guarded recess of our soul. Into this harbor we bring her. A vague and twisted terrain becomes inhabited. Each shadow, touched by the expiration, blooms into a flower of act, as if we are an island upon which a woman, tossed by her laboring vanity and blind self-seeking, is blown, and there finds security until an instant before the anticlimax. Nature, with a smile, thumps down her trump, and the island sinks beneath the sea. There is great truth in those motion pictures which are slandered as true neither to the Bible nor to life. They are, written though they are by the demons and drunks, true to both. We are all Solomons, lusting for Sheba's salvation. The God-filled man is filled with a wilderness that cries to be populated. The stony chambers need jewels, furs, tents of cloth, and flesh, even though, as in Samson's case, the temple comes tumbling. Women are an alien race of pagans set down among us. Every seduction is a conversion. Who has loved and not experienced that sense of rescue? It is not true that our biological impulses are tricked out of rebounds of chivalry. Rather, our chivalric impulses go clanking and encumbering biological armor. Eunuchs love, children love, I would love. My chief exercise, as I sit above the crowds, is to lift the whole mass into immortality. It is not a light task. The throng is so huge, and its members so individually unworthy. No memento mori is so clinching as a photograph of a vanishing crowd. Cheering Roosevelt, celebrating the armistice, there it is, wearing its 10,000 straw hats and stiff collars, a fearless and wooden-faced bustle of life, and it is gone. A bygone crowd dies in the street like a derelict. It leaves no heir, no trace, no name. My own persistence beyond the last rim of time is easy to imagine. Indeed, the effort of imagination lies the other way, to conceive of my ceasing. But when I study the vast tangle of humanity that blackens the beach as far as the sand stretches, absurdities crowd in on me. Is it as maiden, matron, or crone that the females will be eternalized? What will they do without children to watch and gossip to exchange? What of the thousand deaths of memory and bodily change we endure? Can each be redeemed as a final adjustments counter? The sheer numbers involved make the mind scream. The race is no longer a tiny clan of simian aristocrats lording it over an ocean of grass. Mankind is a plague racing like fire across the exhausted continents. This immense clot gathered on the beach, a fraction of a fraction, can we not say that this breeding swarm is its own immortality and end the suspense? The beehive, in a sense, survives. And is each of us not proved to be a hive, a galaxy of cells, each of whom is doubtless praying from its pew in our thumbnail or esophagus for personal resurrection? Indeed, to the cells themselves, cancer may seem a revival of faith. No, in relation to other people, oblivion is sensible and sanitary. The sea of others exasperates and fatigues me most on Sunday mornings. I don't know why people no longer go to church, whether they have lost the ability to sing or the willingness to listen. From 8:30 onward, they crowd in from the parking lot, ants each carrying its crumb of baggage, until by noon, when the remote churches are releasing their gallant and gaily dressed minority, the sea itself is jammed with hollow heads and thrashing arms like a great bobbing backwash of rubbish. A transistor radio somewhere in the sand releases in a thin, apologetic gust the closing peal of transcribed service. And right here, here at the very height of torpor and confusion, I slump, my eyes slit, and the blurred forms of Protestantism's errant herd seem gathered by the water's edge in impassioned poses of devotion. I seem to be lying, dreaming in the infinite rock of space before creation, and the actual scene I see is a vision of impossibility, a paradise. For had we existed before the gesture that split the firmament, could we have conceived of our most obvious possession, our most platitudinous blessing, the moment, the single ever-present moment that we perpetually bring to our lips brimful? So, be joyful. Be joyful is my commandment. It is the message I read in your jiggle. Stretch your skins like pegged hides, curing in the miracle of the sun's moment. Exult in your legs scissoring, your waists swivel. Romp, eat the froth, be children. I am here above you. I have given my youth that you may do this. I wait. The tides of time have treacherous undercurrents. You are born continually toward the horizon. I have prepared myself. My muscles are instilled with everything that must be done. Someday my alertness will bear fruit. From near the horizon there will arise, delicious, translucent, like a green bell above the water, the call for help, the call, a call. It saddened me to confess that I have yet to hear. And now, also from the June 17, 1961 edition of the New Yorker magazine, a poem by Ogden Nash, entitled All Quiet Along the Potomac Except the Letter G. The table talk in Washington, I hear by special messenger, is brightened by the presence there of Clippinger and Kissinger. The anecdotes are rittier, the chitter chat flows ripplinger, as of the moment on the bus when Kissinger met Kiplinger. "My name is Mr. Kiplinger," said Kiplinger to Kissinger. "And I'm Professor Kissinger," replied his fellow passenger. "You'll kindly note my G is hard," said Kiplinger to Kissinger. "Some people call me Kiplinger, and nothing is depressinger." "Hard G to me," said Kissinger. "It is a sentimental goo." Kissinger means more osculent than who? "One dowager," said Kiplinger, "goes far beyond Kiplingery. She dragged me to the opera to add insult to injury." Kiplinger grew progressively Pressinger. "Do you know my good friend Arthur Schlesinger?" Kissinger answered his fellow passenger. "No, but I know an Arthur Schlesinger in a city named for George or Martha. How odd that we should each know an Arthur. Let's have a foursome at Burning Tree, your Arthur and you against mine and me." And now, back to the May 13, 1950 edition of the New Yorker magazine, a poem by Vladimir Nabokov entitled The Room. The room a dying poet took at nightfall in a dead hotel had both directories, the Book of Heaven and the Book of Bell. It had a mirror and a chair. It had a window and a bed.
Its ribs let in the darkness where rain glistened and a shop sign bled. Not tears, not terror, not a blend of anonymity and doom. It seemed that room to condescend to imitate a normal room. Whenever some automobile subliminally slit the night, the walls and ceiling would reveal a wheeling skeleton of light. Soon afterward, the room was mine. A similar stripling cageling. I groped for the lamp and found the line. Alone, unknown, unloved, I die. In pencil, just above the bed. It had a false quotation air. Was it a she, wild-eyed, well-read, or a fat man with thinning hair? I asked a gentle Negro maid. I asked a captain and his crew. I asked the night clerk, undismayed. I asked a drunk. Nobody knew. Perhaps when he had found the switch, he saw the picture on the wall and cursed the red eruption which tried to be maples in the fall. Artistically in the style of Mr. Churchill at his best, those maples marched in double file from Glen Lake to Rested Rest, Restricted Rest. Perhaps my text is incomplete. A poet's death is, after all, a question of technique, a neat enjambment, a melodic fall. And here a life had come apart in darkness, and the room had grown a ghostly thorax with a heart unknown, unloved, but not alone. Well, we've run out of time for another broadcast of the New Yorker Hour. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangle reading service.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.